Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right. Please welcome our 40-minute speaker tonight, Larry T. from Long Beach.
Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And if you're new, in parts of the country, they say that the newcomer is the most important person in this room. Not here. I believe the old coffee maker is the most important one in this room tonight. Pretty damn obvious, man. Coming to a meeting with no coffee, it's like going to a bar with no liquor, man. You know, God damn it, make some, you know. I'm glad to be here. I got some news for you if you're new, though. I was watching on the CNN a couple nights ago that they found a cure for alcoholism. And they invented it over in Switzerland, and it comes in the form of a pill. So don't rush into this thing. There's some hope for you out there. My first thought is I wondered what two would do. You know, and can you crush them up, maybe, you know? I'm always glad to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous once I get here. It's those 2 hours before. My head just, I got a head that loves to chat. And it never tells me anything good, you know? It was up all night last night chatting. Hey, I know you're in there, let's chat, you know? And the more tireder you are, the more it wants to chat, right? And around 2:30, it makes the knock. Hey, come on, let's talk about when you're a baby and bring you right up to date, for God's sakes, you know? And I figure, my God, we just, you know, and the frustrating part about that is we just did it the night before, right? You know, they don't care, you know. Its job is to just talk crap to me, and I believe it, man. Left to my own devices, there is nothing worse than me-on-me action. I tell you, nothing ever comes out good, man, you know. I need to be around other people. And that's the hardest thing for me to do, because I don't mix. And I remember being new in Alcoholics Anonymous and thinking, man, how do you guys do this? How do you talk so long to one another? You know, what the hell are you talking about, you know? And then, you know, over a period of time, you realize that when you talk to an alkie, we have a special quality. Alcoholics are the only people who can look you square dead in the eye and not hear a goddamn thing you're saying. You know what I mean? You know, but the meetings. I love the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for a little over 29 years and not amount to a damn thing. So I don't know where you think you're going if you're new, but the highest I've ever gotten here is sober, basic human being, active member of my own home group. And that's my saving grace. Not to be a speaker, not to be a husband, but to be an active member of a home group. That means more to me than anything I know. Not just somebody who puts in a dollar, but somebody who still has a job in the meeting. For one reason and one reason only, I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I'll never make it back. And there's a myth in Alcoholics Anonymous that the longer you stay sober, the least you have to do. And that's killing people. Because there's more people, the alcoholic who still suffers, usually the guy with over 10 years, who seems to have heard everything but is still restless, irritable, and discontented, and has become so concerned with his material gains that he doesn't give a hoot about how he got them and where he got them from. Spoiled by his great blessings, the book says. And I never want to do that. I never want to forget from whence I came, you know. Had a weird thing that happened to me again. You know, I was in a mall and over at Glendale Mall, and this kid comes walking by me. It was about a week ago. And he had his mom's earrings on, right? He had a ball bearing in his head. Had a ball bearing in his eye. Had a ring in his nose, right? Had a ball bearing in his tongue. Had a big hole in his ear. You ought to put rims in those things, you know? Put a spinner in there or something, right? You know? And he's all tatted down, and he walks by me, and he goes, "What the hell are you looking at?" I says, "I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at, you know. But I recognize the attitude, that's for damn sure, you know." Well, we started joking around and talking and stuff like that, and now I sponsor the guy. And he calls me up and he says, "What do you want me to do?" And I says, "Well, Ron," I says, "why don't you unlock yourself, for God's sake, you know?" And, "Well, I go to these meetings and I feel so different." "Really? Maybe you're the only one wrapped up in a chain link fence, Ronnie. How about that, you know? How many guys you see wearing your hat in a meeting, for God's sakes, you know? Even when we robbed houses, we took off our hats." I come from a great home. I had great parents. My mom's still alive. She's a great lady. I was born in Detroit. Come out to California when I was about 3 or 4 years old. Brought up in a foster home for a while. They got together again. My mom's a neat lady. My mom was still is a little Scandinavian lady. And I remember my mom loved diet pills. She was always eating that speed and running around the house, you know, sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage all night, you know, raking the neighbor's yard around 4 o'clock in the morning, you know. Just a busy lady. Had no idea. It was my first tweaker I'd ever seen, you know. There she was just doing shit all night, you know. And the house was real small. She used to eat that speed and just make Afghans, you know. All night, just Afghans, you know. Just chairs had Afghans, couches had Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodle heads, you know. And if there's any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And just, and the diet was working. She was down to a stick. She had a little room, and you can hear her knitting all night, just going to town, man. She had a favorite hobby. Well, she had a couple of them, you know, but her favorite one was to eat that speed and make these big jigsaw puzzles, right? These 30 million piece jigsaw puzzles of the Mojave Desert, right? She'd get all excited. "It's going to be a beige night tonight, honey," you know, and she'd run down to Savon's and buy her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because they had coupons on the back, and she saved those coupons to buy more yarn. A hideous cycle she was caught up in, right, you know? And you know, she'd get her carton of Raleigh cigarettes and get her prescription filled and come back home and put on her one and only muumuu she had for 40 years, right? And put the... Wow. You remember that muumuu, do you? Nothing like having that muumuu on, right? Don't let the light hit you. And she'd eat that speed and make these puzzles. And by golly, if she had a piece that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers. She just snipped that son of a bitch down, you know, just wedged that thing in there, you know. And I loved being around my mom. I loved hanging around my mom. I knew she loved me. I was her favorite son. I knew that. I was her only son. It was an easy hit, you know. But what would happen to me when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous is I would take this fourth and fifth step with a sponsor. And I would find out, even way back then, as a young kid, what I would do with people who would give me love and attention and affection. And it started way back then, all the way up till I got sober into Alcoholics Anonymous, a little over 30 years old. And that is, whenever anybody would give me love or attention, I would play them like a fiddle. And there would never be a time too inconvenient, growing up, for me not to put the touch on that lady. I never want to forget that. I never want to forget what it's like to be this young man's age or some of these other guys in here and get put away for a short period of time and get cut loose, and you're supposed to come back home on a Monday, but you don't show up on a Monday. you show up on a Thursday, and you don't show up at home, but you show up at your mom's place of business, right? A nice cold April morning, and you're standing in a parking lot of a dry cleaner, and I'm about from here to that back wall, and that rain's hitting me, and I've got my drunken mud on, and my mom's in this dry cleaner's because she works at a dry cleaner's and cleans homes, and I'm ashamed of her, but I'm in that parking lot, and that rain's hitting me, and the only thought that I have is she better have a buck. And I walk through that rain, and one more time startle that lady with my presence, which would be an ongoing thing in this young lady's life. And without batting an eye, I ask her for some money. And she opens up that little Woolworth wallet of hers, and a picture of me falls out when I'm 8 years old on a Little League team. And that would be the only decent picture she'd ever have of me till I met you. And without batting an eye, she gives me that $1 and $2, and I take that money, and I run off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me, if you're new, is you take the same man who's new in Alcoholics Anonymous, with my so-called willingness and going to any lengthness, and stick me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, much like this one, where every action that I take, my life depends on. You see, because there's some of us who are alcoholics, and every action we take here, our life depends on it. We're not doing it to get out of the heat, or because if we don't do it, we're going to die. Some of us have that, we're under the lash. And you stick me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where every action that I take, my life depends on. And you stick the secretary of that meeting that same distance as me and my mom and that dry cleaners. And I need to ask you something if you're new. How come when my life depends on it, I can't walk that 50 feet and ask a man for a job in a meeting that's going to save my life, but I can walk that distance and use my mom and people like her time and time and time again? And I'm here to share with you that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will, make no mistake about that, which is why it's necessary for me to be involved with you. And if I can find the key, if I can find that thing that keeps me from serving you, I will have found the key to life. I will have found the key to life. Because once I began to serve you, you couldn't help but keep it from bleeding in every area of my life. You can't stop this thing. This program's designed to work. And it'll work in every area of your life. You put this program to use on your alcoholism, and you take your hands off your personal life, and you can't keep your personal life from blossoming. This is the most miraculous thing that doesn't need your help. And it just works that way, and I had no idea. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues and that King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. He used to get drunk and sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing. Which I think is a lost art. That old window climbing alky, man, you know, sneaking in his own house or one that looked like it. Huh? Spending all night banging on a window that ain't yours, right? And my dad used to, you know, he was a refinery worker, and he'd sneak into my bedroom, and I could feel that big boot coming down on my chest one night, and I grabbed his little leg, and I said, "Dad," I said, "why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys? My God, you know, she's up anyway, you know. I can hear the Hoover going now, for God's sake, you know." And man, I remember as a kid chasing that guy for his approval. I wanted my old man's approval so bad. And not just as a kid, but ever since I started doing disapproving things, really. But I knew he was a man. He reeked of being a good man. He had a lot of character, and he made drinking look good. His drinking didn't scare me. I knew that old fart found something. He used to get drunk and play those old Bobby Darin records all damn night, you know. You can hear him in the other room and Mack the Knife. Oh, the shock. And he would just sing the same verse all damn night, man. I wanted to come out there and move his head so it just skipped to another verse, you know. But man, he had character. My dad was the type of guy that he started things and finished them, you know. He was a hard-working guy. And he had a lot of good qualities. And my mom had a lot of good qualities. The old man used to tell me, "You don't know how good you got it. Back when I was your age, son, we really had it tough." And he did. He had a hell of a life. brought up back there in Detroit and Chicago, and his father died at an early age, choked on his tongue in an alcoholic convulsion. His mother hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. And he had a dream, and that dream was to marry my mom. Get out of the Navy and come to California and live the good life. And work so hard that their kids would never have to live that life that they did. That's all they wanted. And that's why I never seen them around the house. That's why I was always whining, how come you guys are never around? Well, they were out trying to make a good life for us, you know. And I wanted that old man's approval because I knew there was something about me that would never cut it like him. That guy had character, you know. But of all the things that they had in that house and all the qualities that were in that house, and we didn't have a ton of money, the only thing that I would ever take out of that house and bring into every room that I ever sit in, including Alcoholics Anonymous, the only thing I ever took out of that house was guilt and shame. That's the only thing I've ever carried with me. And I'm an 11-year-old kid, and I'm doing all these things that all these other kids are doing. I'm playing Little League and skipping school and stuff like that. But I'm growing around kids who seem to grasp and develop manners of living. They seem to be growing up, and they seem to just know how to start, you know, handling things and stuff like that. And then I feel like I'm dragging an anchor. I feel like I've got weird stamped on my forehead. I'm doing all these other things that these kids are doing, but man, I'm coming home empty. And I've got this gnawing feeling, and I'm always having the fight to feel good, and I'm always comparing, and I'm always a little bit restless and irritable and discontent. That restlessness that the book talks about. They're not talking about the jitters, that kind of restlessness where your leg's always moving around, that kind of shit. They're talking about that mental restlessness that the alcoholic has that never leaves them alone, that you're never happy with what's going on with you now, no matter how good it is. You've got that mental restlessness that's always throwing you back in the past or afraid to look at the future, and you just can't stay in the now. And the now is where people would really like you to be. You know what I mean? That's really where it counts. You know what I mean? But I could never, never be comfortable in the now. And I remember being 11 years old, man, and I just went out to the garage and I took a, you know, me and a couple of these buddies of mine took a shot of Four Rose whiskey. And it was the first thing that ever come natural to me. There was a guy down the street, Danny, who was a natural at baseball. There was a girl down the street who was natural at English. And I just done the thing that came natural to me. Nobody had to talk me into it. They didn't have to pay me. They didn't have to dare me. I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey and I found everything that I would need to sustain me to life. It was the answer. Now, I threw up. And, you know, I didn't head out to Skid Row that next day and lose my paper out and come to AA or anything, you know what I mean? I did kiss my first Latin woman that night, which meant a lot to me. It was my aunt. But by golly, it's a start, you know? And but I never forgot that place that it took me to, because I would be stepping into that place every time I took a shot of alcohol. It opened up this little window that I stepped into where everything was all right. That the answer to whatever was going on with me at that time was answered. And there was no longer feeling crappy or anything like that. It evened out the playing field. Man, for the first time in my life, it gave me a sense of ease and comfort, a sense of well-being that I wouldn't be able to find when I was sober. No matter how good or bad my life was, I would never have that sense of well-being that alcohol gave me. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, you begin to see that alcohol may look like a problem, but that the longer you use it, it becomes your answer. It becomes the only answer. And it remains an answer long after it's done answering shit. You know, it'll always be the answer to the alcoholic. You know? And I had no idea. And the longer I drank, the smaller that window got, and the smaller that window got, and the smaller that window got. And by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't drinking and stepping into a big, beautiful window. I was hoping that one would just pop open. Because the only dream that I'd ever have wasn't to be a plumber or an engineer. The only dream that I'd ever be marshaled with would be the dream that would drive me to insanity and death. And that is the dream that maybe this time it'll be different. I've got to find a way to keep this stuff in my life if it's the last thing I do. My book talks about a middle-of-the-road answer. We read a part of this book where it says, science may one day accomplish this, but they haven't done so yet. And I would sit in your meetings going, boy, are they still looking, you know? There's got to be a middle-of-the-road answer because I couldn't imagine life without it. And like I said, I started drinking at 11, and the older I got, the more I leaned on it, and the more responsibility I was supposed to be having by growing up, well, the more I would drink. And by the time I got into high school, kids were going to their lockers to get their books, and I was going to my lockers to get barbiturates to take away the shakes. And a freshman year in high school, I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she had some brothers, and her brothers had lowered cars, and back then, we used to lower our Chevrolets right down. I had a 62 yellow Impala dropped right down to the damn ground, man. Had my hair up all big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, right? Drive around and drink that wine and listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Smokey Robinson. And God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck. I was in my plumbing truck today and I heard the Four Tops and I just started sinking in my damn truck, man. I had white t-shirts and black khaki pants that came up to here. My girlfriend, her friends were telling me, her girlfriends were saying that men who are well endowed had big feet. I had a pair of 15-inch shoes I was driving around in, right? Had my big hair and my big feet, right? Driving around. Somebody tripped over my foot tonight and I felt proud. You know, let me move that thing. It's going to be a while, you know. I loved it. I had a girlfriend named Loopy. We'd drive around and drink that wine all night, man. One night we're drinking that wine and that 151 rum. Oh, man. Drinking the 151. Driving down Hawthorne Boulevard. She says, what else? Driving to the Jack in the Box. Let's talk to the puppet. You know? Like he's a real guy, right? Yeah, let's go talk to him, see what he's up to, right? Well, I can't see the puppet, you know. I see about 10 puppets, man. I'm buzzed. I can't see it, so I put the old hand over the eye, and I'm driving up trying to talk to the puppet, and I run over him, you know. And his head's hanging down, right, and he's yelling at me, can I have your order, please, right? The cops come, they arrest me, they throw me on the hood of the car, and they shatter my hair all over the place. And I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal. Let Rudy drive. There's nothing like driving shotgun, man. You know, you get to drink all night and look at yourself in the rearview mirror, man. You want to get an Alfie's attention, put a mirror in front of him, man. We had 10 guys in the bathroom tonight. Just, man, let me in there. You know what I mean? I'd look at myself in that mirror and I'd go, my God, look at you. You ought to be an underwear model or something, you know. And you don't wear any, but what the hell, you know. And been drinking all night. Your hair's all big and flat because you've been sleeping on the window, right? Got some cigarette butt stuck in there. Got 30 pounds of tamale puke on your chest. And I feel like dancing when I look like that. I don't know about you. And I feel like going to the Bounty Room. I dance the salsa. I love to dance the salsa and the merengue and stuff. And so we go to the Bounty Room or Leonardo's, you know, and we'd have that Jade East on because we're going to catch. Catch the clap is what you're going to get, you know. Go to the Bounty Room, you know, and you just hear that music outside the bar, man. You just pound your heart, you know, and you go into the bar and you see your salsa queen and she's all the way back at the bar, right? She's got her hair up real big. She's got flies stuck in her hair. She's got 20 pounds of tamale puke in her chest. She's back there gnawing on a pickled pig's feet. I like that about a woman, you know, and I've got to talk to her, right? And my feet are so big, I feel like I'm skiing. You know. Finally get up there, man, have a couple more shots of 151 and start telling her about the dream we're going to dream that night, you know, and wait till I get you to that single wide trailer of mine in Gardena, you know. There's magic in there, you know. I'm talking to her for about 10 minutes, and her lesbian girlfriend comes up, starts beating the crap out of me, man. Just, damn, get the hell out of here, you know. And I don't know what hit me, but I want to run, but I can't because my foot's so big that it's stuck between the foot rail and the bar, and I can't get out of there, man. And this old bag's kicking the snot out of me, and I keep coming up like a doll, man. She, bam, like that. And I had no idea I was a victim of gay bashing back then, but she kicked the snot out of me for about 2 hours. But I loved it. I loved those nights. And those nights happened a lot. And those nights are the nights that I would wish would come back. Those are the nights that I wish that maybe this time it would be different. Because towards the end, I'm not having those kind of drunks anymore. Towards the end, I just want the hallucinations to go away. I want to keep from having these damn convulsions. I think I've turned into an epileptic. Every time I don't drink, I'm flopping around like a salmon somewhere, you know, and I don't know what that's about, you know. And so I get afraid not to drink. And the longer I stay sober, the worse I feel. And I discovered that in Alcoholics Anonymous, that alcoholics of my type, it seems like sobriety drives us to drink. And we keep getting sober, and we keep getting drunk, and we keep getting sober, and we keep getting drunk, and there's never anything in between. And when I'm drunk, I wish I was sober, and when I'm sober, I wish I was drunk, and there just isn't any hope because both of them aren't working. And they even smell the same, you know? And there just isn't any hope left. And I've got this noodle that's telling me that if I could just get my life in order, if I could just get a car and a job and a hotel and stuff, and maybe everything would be all right. If I could just get this, get on my feet. And every time I get on my feet, the same thing happens. What's the big deal? There's nothing that a couple drinks won't hurt. Now I'm doing okay, and I'm off and running. And it seemed like my life was a series of fresh starts. You see, I'm a loser. And the only way that a loser gets hope is not through working through stuff. Losers get hope by starting over. And I took an inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life was a series of fresh starts. I'm always starting over. Because there's nothing like the hope of a new start. Nothing like it, man. There's just light on the horizon, man. Every time I'm sobering up, and new hotel, new PO, right? New city, this time it's going to be different. And everything's good for 60, 80 days, man. Around 1969, a bunch of us are going places. Some of them are going to Vietnam, and some of us are turning hippie and going to San Francisco. And I thought, well, maybe I'd find my roots and go to Detroit. And I wound up in Phoenix. Over there off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel. It's a beautiful hotel. It's about 6 floors. Everybody has a TV. It's in the lobby. Everybody has a bathroom and it's down the hall. And you have a little room where there's a Murphy bed and a sink on a wall, and you drink and you dream and you die. And you know, one of these days it ain't going to be like this. And the only thing you have any hope is that you look at the wagon wheel bar across the street. It has no windows, just a dirty old curtain blown out of it. And you go down there and you meet your buddy, Ernie. Ernie's an idea man from Tennessee. Ernie tells me, I know what you're going to do. He says, come back down here tomorrow, Larry. I know a guy that's a plumber. Come down here tomorrow and we'll get you a job. I show up in the morning and I meet this plumber. Takes me out to the desert and sticks me underneath the house. He says, all I want you to do is hang copper, kid. Just stay under here and hang copper. And he gave me a transistor radio. And I got a pint of Kessler's. And I'm underneath this house, right? You see this stray cat over there? And I'm thinking, my God, I'm on top of the world. I got it made under here. Nobody knows I'm under here. I got a pint. I got a transistor. I got a pet. You know, every now and then I'll bang on the pipe. I really thought I was just was great, man. And I think, well, perfect time to start taking shots of that hot bourbon, you know, and get busy here. 9 hours later, they're dragging me out from underneath the house. Apparently, I got drunk and broke through the floor and robbed a lady of all of her jewelry. They're dragging me out. This cat comes running out with a bunch of necklaces on, right? They arrest me, and I get out of there a couple days later and go back to the wagon wheel. And Ernie says, I know what we're going to do. He says, not too far from here is a horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey. I said, all right, man. I'm going to start working out and getting into shape, right? And he gave me a bag of speed. Oh, I don't do speed. You know, I've just been drinking and doing heroin, minding my own business, you know. ain't going to be no Afghan maker, that's for damn sure, you know. And No, you just take this and we'll get you down to 95 pounds and we'll go away you in 2 months. He was sure it was going to, well, hell, he was 108, you know, like that. He goes, I'll come back in 2 months and we'll go weigh you in, you know. And he left me this bag and he took off. And 2 weeks later, he comes back and I haven't moved an inch in that room. I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any goddamn horse I've ever seen. You can get a saddle on me and ride my ass around here, right? And all I'm doing is chasing a fly around my room and looking out my window every 10 seconds. What's that? What's that? What's that? You know, and seeing these black and white flashes, and that's the damn sun going up and down, you know. And anything that's white, I'm putting in that pipe, you know. It could be a goddamn toenail. It's going in there, man, you know. And he come back and he goes, you couldn't have possibly taken it. Well, I did. I need some more now, man. I'm all sucked up, you know. My hair's all up and I got froth coming down here, you know. And you couldn't have possibly taken it. Well, I did, you know. And so we canned that idea. And the worst 18 days of my life, man. And he said, then I started working for I started working for another plumber. And I worked for him for about, I don't know, 2 hours. Well, I found out he was younger than me. And I ain't working for a kid. I got my pride, you know. And so I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury and went to the county hospital. And on the way there, got me a pint of PM bourbon and went to the doctor. And he gave me a prescription for Percodan. And then he took off and left me a box of blank prescription pads. That he took those things and started running down North Central with my box of prescription. Ran into the bar and Ernie made a phone call to some guys down in Nogales and Tucson. And we started writing prescriptions and selling them. Started writing prescriptions for Secanol and Tuanol and Nebutol. You name it all. We wrote it all. damn near took it all too, you know. And after 9 months, they caught up with me, and when you're loaded on bourbon and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase, right? Oh, there he goes, down the 5. You know, none of that happening. It's just a matter of the sheriff coming into the old Busy Bee Hotel going, well, there he is under there, you know. And no big getaway. He just curled up butt naked, you know. So they put me away in a jail for a small, I'm no big-time convict. I'm a loser. And what came out in an inventory is that's a nice way of saying that I'm a quitter. And that's what I've been doing my entire life, is quitting. I know how to quit better than anybody I know. And I started quitting at 11. I started quitting when I stopped listening to my mom and dad. I used to think that towards the end that I didn't bother anybody because I'm drinking alone. Every time I drank, I took a couple people with me. Every time I drank, I took my mom and dad with me. Every time I drank, they'd be looking out those windows and hearing those sirens. Oh yeah, there was no drinking by yourself. There was somebody with me every time. I never want to forget that. I never want to forget by the grace of God in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Funny thing we throw around here in Alcoholics Anonymous, the grace of God. It's thrown around a lot. And you people in this room taught me what the grace of God means for people like me. And the grace of God is this thing where God has this compassion for the suffering. He's got this compassion for us. Having the grace of God is what was taught to me by people like you. And that is, I began to have the grace of God when I started having compassion for the man who was suffering. When you start showing that same compassion that God showed for you, you've just touched the surface of the grace of God. The grace of God isn't just for something for you to hold on to and get emotional over. The grace of God is given to you because there's work to be done. We don't need any more cheerleaders for God. We need coffee makers. That's obvious. But He needs people to do the work. He needs people to do the work. And so I was put away in an institution for a short period of time. And in 1974, I came back to California, Los Angeles, and signed up with a probation officer again, and he put me on Anabuse in 1974 and stuck me in a little hotel in downtown Torrance, the Greyhound Hotel. And beautiful hotel. Everybody's got a TV. It's in the lobby. And I look out my window and drink and dream and die. In 1974, he put me on Anabuse. And it'd be the first time that I'd ever be sober in my life. Not drinking or using, and I was that way for a couple months, and I got a little laborer job because I didn't have a license. I took a bus down to the refinery, and I'm there about 3 hours early, and I go to a Little League dugout across the street to wait for the gates to open up, and stone cold sober in 1974, I go out of my mind. I unplug the cord. I'm in between hysterical and maniacal. My hallucinations are so intense, and my paranoia is so intense that the hallucinations stick. I become somewhat catatonic, and I can't talk, and somebody calls the paramedics, and they take me to Harbor General Hospital over there in Torrance. And they look at my jacket, and they see by my jacket that maybe because of some of my actions and some of the things that have been, maybe I need to go to a little mental facility and be observed for 30 or 60 days. And a year later, they let me out. Totally observed. And well, we couldn't find nothing either, you know, and gave me my medication to take, and that seemed to work for certain things, but there's one thing you can't medicate out of an alcoholic, and that is this idea that maybe this time it'll gotta be different. See, I'm an alcoholic. The memory of my last drunk doesn't have sufficient force to keep me sober, no matter how nasty that last drunk is. It doesn't have sufficient force to keep me sober. So I'm not one of these guys that can say, you know, I'm sober because I remember my last drunk. I'm an alcoholic. The memory of my last drunk, no matter how nasty it is pushed away by the longer I stay sober. And the longer I stay sober, I'm not drinking because of memory of a last drunk. I'm drinking because of the pain that I feel right now, which has overcome any last drunk. Because the only thing that sobriety has ever squeezed out of me is this idea that maybe this time it'll be different. That's the only thing sobriety ever squeezed out of me. You see, I'm an alcoholic. Every time I stop drinking, I can see the faces of everybody that I have used and abused and have hurt and have terrorized my entire life. I'm an alcoholic. Every time I'm sober, I can see the physical things happening in my body, and I can't believe it either. I can see the liver and the pancreas and the blood and the puffiness and things and the hallucinations and the convulsions. I see that, and I can't believe it either. And every time I'm sober, I know the threats of the institution that are coming. But the baffling feature about my malady is every time I'm sober, I come up with a profound idea that maybe this time it'll be different. And that becomes the ongoing fact of my life. And I had no idea that I was suffering from a thing called alcoholism. That it only strikes me when I'm sober. And that once I'm drunk, its job is done. I had no idea what was going on with me. And I come out of that institution in 1975, and I run out of Thorazine after 2 months, and they find me over at Alvaro Street, over by a Chevron station, curled up like a dead dog. They rolled me up and sent me up to Wayside for about 40 days, and they put a bunch of us in a black and white bus, and they sent me down to the South Bay Courthouse, where I'm going to be tried and convicted and sent away. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm sitting in a holding tank the size of this room, and everybody's gone. All the buses are gone. All the other guys are gone. I'm sitting on a concrete floor with a Vons bag and no hope, wondering, I wonder where they're going to send me now. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I start hearing the magic that we all hear, and that's some keys. And I hear the jailer coming down there with some keys, and he opens up, he slides open this door in this jail, and there's a Scottish man with a patch standing there. And he says, "Hi, son." He says, "My name is Alex. Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Come with me, son. We're going to AA." And I thought, my God, what's AA? I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA? And who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? And is he real, you know? Looking back, all the way back to 1975, from where I stand right now, I know exactly who he is. There's some of them in here tonight. It's what they call a trusted servant. And what would make that man a trusted servant is that he had no business being there. He wasn't on a panel. He wasn't part of H&I. Wasn't a counselor. Wasn't a probation officer. He was a refinery worker. And he just got the worst news of his life. And that news was that his wife was dying immediately of a terminal disease. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his home group, somewhere in a book study, somewhere with a sponsor, that man was to sit quietly and grasp and develop a manner of living, which is unheard of anymore, and that is that practical experience tells us that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. That this works when other activities fail. And a thought came to that man's mind, and he turned his car around, and he went to the South Bay Courthouse, and he talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth. And they said, I think we got a guy for you. And that man came down and took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm ready for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch, right? He takes me to a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he drives up to this dingy, stinky, smelly, rotten, dirty, pukey little Alano Club called the Torrance Lamita Alano Club. What the hell is an Alano? You know, I'm thinking, is that like an elk or a moose, you know? Watch for crossing Alanos? What the hell is it, you know? And we pull up into this Alano Club, and there's all the Alanos walking around, man. Everybody's got a nickname and a tattoo. He introduced me to all these people, Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people. My God, I just left a group of people like this, you know. Little Moose comes running across the club. Hi, honey, my name is Moose and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are, Moose. I said, I'm not it, man, you know. And then this big transvestite came out of the card room. He starts circling me like a helicopter in Norwalk, man. He finally lands. He comes walking over to me in his new moo-moo, and he says, hi. He says, I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting. Candlelight meeting? I said, I don't think so, man, you know. Not till I get a year anyway, you know. I told Alex, I said, my God, that guy's got big feet, man, you know. And I thought, my God, if this is Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't want any part of this, you know. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. And the biggest lie that I told myself was that I was coming in and out of AA. I hadn't touched Alcoholics Anonymous. What I did is what I've been doing my entire life, though. I was sitting in a room waiting for people to do something for me. I've been doing that my entire life. Whether it be a room from the state, the county, give me a county check, a state check, a block of cheese, some shit. I've always been waiting in a room waiting for people to do something for me. And I had that same attitude here. And lo and behold, the miracle happened that what I was waiting to be done to me, God was waiting to do through me. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's nothing here to get. You don't even get sober here. You get sober around the toilet in your room. This is what you do now that you're sober. Do you want sobriety and a brand new way of life? Or is that life you're living just tickling the shit out of you? I wanted a brand new way of life because I didn't know how to live. And you people seem to be doing this thing with your nicknames and tattoos, but you were living longer than I could ever imagine. And I wanted a brand new way of life. The only thing that I can promise you're going to get if you're new is be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life. Because this is the longest thing I've ever done against my will. That's for damn sure, man. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous in those years, people would come and get me, and they were always clean and they were sharp. And I would call Central Office, and people would come and get me. And they would pull me out of an alley or pull me out of some place and say, are you ready to go to a meeting? And that's why I wear a tie. I wear a tie not because I think I'm sharp and effective. I wear a tie because there's some people in this room who took the time out of their life to show me how to live a life where I have respect for the thing that's saving my life and the people in it. everything that I needed to know about life would be shown to me in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, starting in my meetings and starting with respect. You see, this is more than a room for me to sit in. When I could start respecting this gift called Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in it, when I could start respecting the meetings and the structures of the meetings and the quietness of the meetings and all that and the self-support, when I could start respecting the thing that saved my life, it was amazing how I began to bring that into the other areas of my life. I began to respect the boss like I would a sponsor. I began to respect a woman that I call my wife like the ladies in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how I learned how to live. By learning how to sit and behave in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I could show respect for the thing that's saving my life, you can't help this thing from bleeding in every area of your life. It's designed to work. I get sick and tired of people coming up to this box and telling people that AA don't work for me. AA don't work for me. AA don't work for me. Well, I got news for you. AA don't work for me either. Doesn't work for him and it doesn't work for him. We work for it. This isn't any place to get. There's a lot of work to be done. And the more you do that work. You see, what I found by you people is the more that I serve you, the clearer he becomes. And the more that I serve me, the darker I become. And it becomes necessary for me to live this way, not so that I can do anything but be a service. You see, you guys lit a fire under me. My sponsor took me through these steps and you lit a little fire under me. And I'm so grateful that I was around people in the home group who fanned that fire. Because the biggest problem with Alcoholics Anonymous is that there's people sitting next to these newcomers telling them, oh, you don't got to do that. Oh, you don't have to go there. Oh, you don't have to go to so many meetings. They're killing them. Telling a new guy what he don't have to do. I don't ever want to be that guy. I am so glad that you guys got me busy in this way of life. You got me busy long before any miracle happened. You got me busy being with you. On May 2nd, 1982, I wound up at the Beacon Light Mission in Wilmington. I'm going by a Woolworth window and I'm 120 pounds and I'm yellow. I got everything I own on my back. And I ain't drunk. But I'm looking through this window wondering whatever happened to my dreams. On May 2nd, 1982, I knew that rolling around with the pigs that day wasn't going to be enough to keep me sober. And I was afraid I was going to drink it again. And everything in me wanted to be sober. I didn't want to die this way. And I knew I was going to get drunk again because I'd been here before. And I called up a man in Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, I'm down at the Beacon Light Mission. Will you come and get me? I'm ready to come back to AA. And that man told me the most profound thing I've ever heard. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty ass down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. And I thought, my God, whatever happened to that AA love? You know, and I just heard it. And for the first time in my life, it was up to me to come to you. And for 10 miles, I shook and I hallucinated and I wanted to drink at every little liquor store that I passed by. But my eyes were focused on this guy that I wanted to talk to, this bald-headed carpenter named Don. And I got to that club and I asked that man something I never asked a man. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? The hardest thing I've ever had to do, and it was the thing that turned the corner. It was the best thing I've ever done. And that man said, he lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds and he lit into me for 20 minutes. And he told me under no certain terms would he put up with my nonsense. He gave me the Declaration of Independence. You make the effort, I make the effort. You don't make the effort, don't bother me, kid. And that man was my first sponsor, and I love him, and I love him now. May 2nd, 1982, I never had to live that way. I got a little story to tell you, and I'm running out of time, but through the amends and stuff like that, I wasn't supposed to see a little girl. And at 5 years sober, I got a divorce. It was the first time I was ever married, and it lasted for a year and a half, and there was a little girl, my daughter Lauren came out of that. And the women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, you may not be somebody's husband, but you'll always be somebody's father. Don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at. Don't you ever let her wonder. You send her postcards, you write her on Pocahontas paper, you phone call her, but you never let her wonder where you're at. And if you can go to San Diego and talk, you can drive to Phoenix and see your daughter. But don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at. And that was 13 years ago. And she was 10 years old when she moved to Phoenix. And I make that drive across that 10 all the way from L.A. to Phoenix to see that little girl. And every time I drive that drive, I think, my God, what kind of dad are you? What kind of dad are you that would just see a little girl part-time? She's going to forget you, Larry. This don't mean nothing to her. This is a waste of time. She needs somebody more steady. This is nonsense. She's just not going to love you. But I kept making that effort. And I would write that little girl, and I would have daughter and daddy dates with her, and I would take her to these places where she could make her own ashtrays and paint her own cups. And every time I would see her, I would just say, man, to myself, what kind of dad are you? Well, the last time I seen her was about a year ago, and she's 23 years old. And I'm sitting across from her, and she's got her mom's earrings on, she's got a ball bearing in her eye, and she's got a ball bearing in her tongue, and she's got a hole in her ear, and she looks at me and she says, what are you looking at? And I said, the most beautiful little girl I've ever seen in my life. She says, Daddy, I got to tell you something. I says, what's that, honey? She says, I've got a man in my life. And she says, I love him. And I says, well, that's great, baby. She says, but there's a glitch. And that's always neat to hear. And I says, what's the glitch, honey? Well, the glitch is that he's divorced and he has a little girl that's 6 years old. And I said, really? She goes, yeah. He was over last night and he was crying. I said, why was he crying? Well, he's afraid that his little girl is going to forget him. And that she's going to forget that he's the dad, and he was scared to death. She says, but he's okay now. And I said, well, what did you tell him? She says, Daddy, I told him to write that little girl every week. And that go see her and take her to places where she can paint her own ashtrays and coffee cups. Call her up. Never let her wonder where she's at. And she says, John, if you do that, that little girl will always love you. I know this for a fact. I damn near miss that. I damn near miss that because of listening to my head. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only power that I need is to be with you. I'm not a very spiritual man. I don't know much about God or anything. All I know is this, that on a Friday night in San Clemente, I see row after row after row of people who should be locked up dead or insane. And look at us tonight. Look at us. We're happy, we're joyous, and we're free. I don't got to hear his voice, and I don't got to wonder what he looks like, but I do got to come back and play in the evidence one more day. Thanks a lot, you guys.